Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in our Creekside room, the speaker is Mary Scott Buria, and she will be speaking on reshaping a multicultural future. So let's listen in on Mary Scott Buria.
Today, we're going to sort of play out a scenario, so I hope you're up for it. So I want you to be a little vulnerable, and hopefully this will work out the way we have it planned. Well, I've had a great time the last couple weeks, and I've learned so much from the interaction. It's refreshed me a lot to hear people's experiences and to talk, and I've been very much impressed with your perspectives. I think I've been very much enriched with your perspectives, and so I feel sort of relaxed today about sort of this particular scenario we're going to play out. But just for people who are new today, I want to just refresh us, just take maybe 5 minutes to just go through and say a little bit about what we've been doing all week, because this will kind of set a context for what you're going to get yourself into for the rest of this hour. Well, we've spent this week, and we did the same last week, talking about multicultural issues, and specifically as it relates to race and racism. And we spent time looking at ourselves, at ourselves as Americans, as white Americans, and acknowledging or looking at the need to acknowledge who we are culturally. Aside from being Americans, being white Americans, but who are we? And who are you as white Americans, and what does that mean? We talked a lot about the persistence of racism. I showed two videos. One which depicted, which showed an experiment which was done in 1965, and again several years after that, for third graders it was based upon the Eye of a Storm. If you're familiar with that, a class divided. And the points that we made was how we are created, how our society creates us as victims and victimizers, oppressors and oppressees. And we talked about lies, liars, and how that continues to get played out in 1994. And we also looked at the persistence of racism and looked at a video entitled True Colors that was done in 1994 that just showed how very subtle racism is in 1994, how different it is than it was in 1964, 1954, 1920. And how persistent it is. And so today, what I'd like to do is I thought about this scenario that's kind of complex, and it is a future that I hope will never happen. But I'm constantly reminded of, I think it's a biblical phrase, and I'm in a biblical place, religious place. I think about these things a lot now. The biblical phrase that says, where there is no vision, the people will perish. And we use that a lot, and we think about that a lot. And we think about that a lot in our church, because we think a whole lot about the vision that's created by us. Though God has a plan and God knows what the future holds, it's ours to sort of work towards God's dream. And so the scenario that we're going to do today is a future that I hope will never happen, but it sort of gives us a scenario of a future that could happen if we don't think about how to create a new future. And I want us to think about some of the continuing questions which we raised this week, which have to do with what does it mean to become multicultural? What does it mean to give up power? Because that really talks a lot about power. And what is the power that shapes America, and how do we capture it and use it for the good of all of us, and not just for a few? And then the final questions, which are posed by two individuals that I have a lot of respect for, are Derrick Bell and Cornel West, and I hope their folks back here. And one is, does America have the will to eliminate racism? And if they do, how will we face and deal with and create a new America? Because we're really shaped by our history of racism in this country. So that's sort of where we've been this week. And thanks to this gentleman here, I brought the handouts that I've been holding in my room for 2 weeks. And never saw a need to use them. And then I realized I don't want to take them home with me. And so I'm going to pass them out. Hopefully, there'll be something that you can use when you go back home. We also, for those that are, of you that are new, created over the last couple of weeks this wall of history, which goes from 1492 to 1994, which is really the history of racism in America. And we asked from last week to this week if people could sort of pinpoint places on this wall that show resistance to racism, and then something about your own cultural heritage. And we use this a lot in our trainings to really kind of depict not just the history of racism in America, but a real strong sort of resistance to that history. And who are the players in that history? I mean, we've all been players in that history of resistance. It hasn't just been a particular group of people. So we ask people to pinpoint those. And then I ask if people could identify maybe heroes or heroines that could recall in this history that really had an identity that lived out a resistance to oppression. Because I think in shaping a new identity, shaping an identity that's not based upon being racist or being participating in a racist society, that there are people in our history who have those identities. We can't recall who those people are. Sort of use them to help us to reshape the identities that we want to have to build in the future. So I ask that people identify some names. And when we did this, it was interesting to me to note that the periods that we had picked out of the wall, and I'll ask you to come up and look at it at the end, and I'm going to take it home, and we keep adding to this and do it all the time, is that this first period, which is from 1492 to 1864, is really the strong period of racism and the period of slavery, which solidified really racism in America. And that was over that period of time. And not only was there the slave trade, where millions of Africans were brought over, but there was really a very strong resistance to it. And 1864 marked the end of the period of slavery, legalized slavery in the United States. And then this next period, which is from 1864 to 1954, was supposed to be a period of prosperity and freedom for the African Americans in this country. And there were laws that were enacted giving slaves their freedom. But there was also, this also marked a time of tremendous sort of illegal slavery, I guess you could say, or where there was tremendous, this was a period where there was a rise in the Ku Klux Klan, where there was also at the same time there was a real growth and sort of development in the African American community. It was a time of the Negro Renaissance. There were a lot of Back to Africa movements, which I think really depicted a very strong sense of identity and a sense of wanting to claim an identity. There was also sort of this real entrenched, sort of different kind of legalized racism that happened during this period of time. So we ended slavery, but we sort of entered into this Jim Crow period. But it was not without its resistance and its undercurrent. And then from 1955 to 1974, again, was the period of the Civil Rights Movement, where we both saw sort of the convergence of both racism and a resistance to racism. And 1955 up to about 1964 was a period where there was tremendous civil rights activity going on around the country, and in particular in the South. But that sort of broke loose in 1968 with the killing of Martin Luther King and everything else that was going on in the country, the Vietnam War, And really, I think America's contradictions look at itself in the face. And so we see that from that period on, though there was a very strong black identity movement, black power movement that was going on, there was also, during that time, the time when the government was really clamping down on social movements tremendously. So that 1974 and on, you almost see a real sort of marrying of a lot of strong movements against racism. And I think a real destruction of organized movements to end racism in the United States. And so what we see now is really very sporadic sort of rebellions or riots or sort of acting out, or whatever you want to call it, that has no organization or has no focus to it. And I think that was probably very systematically done. So there's not a whole lot that we see here. We could probably, you can't see it. I mean, from 1974 to 1994, it's so hard to see what racism is doing in this country because it's no longer legal. You know, slavery ended it, civil rights ended it. So you don't really see it. I mean, you see voting rights, you see housing rights, you see all kinds of things happening that appear to sort of begin to support and encourage the involvement of the black community and acceptance of the black American in America. So you don't really see the racism that's going on. It's really kind of undercurrent and subtle. But I think someone here wrote the LA Rebellion, which I think in some ways, again, slapped America's contradiction in the face, and we sort of see racism played out in a whole different scenario. So anyway, we just keep adding to this, and what I find very fascinating about what gets added to this is not the things that we all know, which is like, you know, the killing of Martin Luther King or, you know, the Civil Rights Act. Those are things that are very publicly known, but little, small, obscure things that happened in various regional places in the country that you and I would never know about if we didn't live there. That are really, I think, are stories that need to be told over and over and over again. I was really impressed when we did this in Minnesota because I'd never been to Minnesota and I didn't know very much about Minnesota's history. And we did this wall of history in Minnesota and there were all kinds of stories. And though most of those stories had a lot to do with Native Americans, they were still stories of racism and resistance to racism in America. And there were stories that I think, again, that we need to know. And I always like to joke and say, when we do this in Chicago, we think that the world ends at, you know, 95th Street. You know, everything happens within the boundaries of Chicago. That represents the world. So we got a history that was full of things that had happened in Illinois and in Chicago, and, you know, not a whole lot about what was going on in the rest of the world. So anyway, if you have a chance, if you need our idea, take a look. So before we go on to our little scenario, are there any comments or questions?
No? Can I just say one thing that I think is very exciting is coming to Golden Village and seeing the mixed families here, couples that they've adopted, other cultures. I just think that's so exciting.
And there's one, I believe it was you that sort of added up here about the Vietnamese. Those are really important, significant steps along the way. Okay, well, let's move along. What I'd like to do is I'm going to read you a couple of things first, and then I'm going to break us up into two groups, and then have you come back. And what you're going to be doing in these groups are really kind of play acting. So. Think about that. Maybe haven't done that for a while. This scenario is, I don't know if you are familiar with Derrick Bell. Derrick Bell was a Harvard law professor up until a couple of years ago, and he basically told Harvard School that if they didn't hire, he was the only African American on staff at the law school, and that if they didn't hire an African American female, that he was going to go on sabbatical until that happened, and they never did, so he resigned from Harvard, which was a very bold step for him. And he has written a couple books, and he has an interesting theory. His theory is that racism in America is a permanent feature of America, and that it'll never go away, and that we have to adjust to that fact and live with that fact. And though I don't know that I quite understand the total basis of his theory, he makes a really compelling argument. And so I don't think that it's a doom and gloom. I don't think it's an argument of doom and gloom. So I want to start out this scenario. And so I want you to pay real close attention, because this is going to be the basis of what we're going to do. This is called the Space Traders. January 1. The first surprise was not their arrival. The radio messages had begun. You were in this before, right? Okay. Do you want your same role?
I wrote it out.
Oh. The first surprise was not their arrival. The radio messages had begun weeks before, announcing that 1,000 ships from a star far out in space would land on 1 January 2000 in harbors along the Atlantic coast from Cape Cod to North Carolina. Well before dawn on that day, millions of people across North America had wakened early to witness the moment the ships entered Earth's atmosphere. However expected to the watchers, children of the electronic age, the spaceship's approach was as awesome as had been that earlier one of three small ships on October over 500 years ago to the Indians of the island of Santo Domingo in the Caribbean. No, the first surprise was the ships themselves. The people who lined the beaches of New Jersey where the first ships were scheduled to arrive saw not anything NASA might have dreamed of, but huge vessels the size of aircraft carriers, which the old men in the crowd recognized as being pretty much like the box-shaped craft that carried Allied troops to the Normandy beachheads during the Second World War. As the sun rose on that cold, bright morning, the people on the shore, including an anxious delegation of government officials and media reporters, witnessed a fantastic display of eerie lights and strange sound, evidently the visitors' salute to their American hosts. Almost unnoticed during the spectacle, the bow of the leading ship slowly lowered. A sizable party of the visitors, the first beings from outer space anyone on Earth had ever seen, emerged and began moving majestically across the water toward the shore. The shock of seeing these beings, regal in appearance and bearing, literally walking on the waves, was more thrilling than frightening. At least no one panicked. Then came the second surprise. The leaders of this vast armada could speak English. Moreover, they spoke in the familiar, comforting tones of former President Reagan, having dubbed his recorded voice into a computerized language translation system. After the initial greetings, the leader of the U.S. delegation opened his mouth to read his welcoming speech, only the first of several speeches scheduled to be given on this historic occasion by the leaders of both political parties and other eminent citizens, including, of course, stars of the entertainment and sports world. But before he could begin, the principal spokespersons for the space people, and it wasn't possible to know whether it was man or woman or something else entirely, raised a hand and spoke crisply to the point. And this point constituted the third surprise. Those mammoth vessels carried within their hulls treasures of which the United States was in desperate need: gold to bail out almost bankrupt federal, state, and local governments, special chemicals capable of unpolluting the environment, which was becoming daily more toxic, and restoring it to the pristine state it had been before Western explorers set foot on it, and a totally safe nuclear engine and fuel, to relieve the nation's all but depleted supply of fossil fuel. In return, the visitors wanted only one thing, and that was to take back to their home star all the African Americans who lived in the United States. The jaw of every one of the welcoming officials dropped. Not a word of the many speeches they had prepared suitable for the occasion. As the Americans stood in stupefied silence, the visitors' leaders emphasized that the proposed trade was for the Americans freely to accept or not, that no force would be used. Neither then nor subsequently did the leader or any other of the visitors, whom anchor persons on that evening news shows immediately labeled the space traders, reveal why they wanted only black people, or what plans they had for them should the United States be prepared to part with that or any other group of its citizens. The leader only reiterated to his still dumbfounded audience that in exchange for the treasure that they had brought, they wanted to take away every American citizen categorized as black on birth certificate or other official identification. The space traders said they would wait 16 days for a response to their offer. That is, on 17 January, the day when in that year the birthday of Martin Luther King was to be observed, they would depart carrying with them every black man, woman, and child in the nation and leave behind untold treasure. Okay. That's the scenario. Now, seems a little far-fetched, right? Might not be that far-fetched. All right. Now, what I need is, I need probably about 7 individuals who will represent the president and the president's cabinet. Now, we already have our Secretary of Health and Human Services, Hilda Hittmeyer, right here. So we need to have, and then we will have one group of our cabinet. And then the other group will be our business people from the community, from the corporate world. So I need about 7 cabinet members. And what I'll have you do is I'll have you sort of convene a little bit in a corner and sort of talk a little bit about this. Great. All right, I'm going to have you, Hilda. Let's see. How about... I have Attorney General, Secretary of the Interior, if you care. Okay. All right.
I thought you were president.
Oh. Yeah, we do have a president or a vice president. Come on, I'm gonna start choosing in a minute. Okay. All right. I have 3 more. And I will be Mr. Good Goldwright, the black conservative. That's a little strange for me. But. Secretary of the Treasury, okay? Now, I do need a president. Now, you can either be the president or the vice president. Now, this will be the, we're coming upon election time, and this will be, this is the first term for this president. It's a very conservative, extremely conservative administration. And so it's right before election time. And you know, this could mean some really great things and could get this administration reelected if they make the right decisions. We do need a president who's somewhat of an opportunist. Now you're acting. Now you have to act. You don't play your own roles. You act out a role. So I do need a president. How about you?
Me?
You president?
I would.
Okay, great. I don't have a card for you. You don't need a card. You just preside.
Oh, great. Okay. Just be opportunistic.
Yeah, just be opportunistic. Okay, now why don't I have you? Maybe you can just go out in the hallway for a quick second and just read your roles and just sort of think a little bit about how you'll get into these roles. Now, again, this is a conservative administration, and for the most part, you're trying to figure out how to get rid of these African Americans. So your roles are sort of based on sort of coming up with those rationales. Okay, and I do need probably about 3 business leaders. These aren't necessarily roles as much as they are sort of scenarios or arguments. Really, they're kind of arguments. We can have some. Well, we have
roles.
Well, just business.
I mean, is there any of that? Your guess is 3.
Well, there is another. There is sort of the anti-trade coalition, which are your typical progressives. But I decided not to sort of play that one out because it was just too. It was too fun. Can I get another baby sitter? Come on. No actors in this bunch. Okay. Let's see. And these again are not roles, they're just sort of arguments. Now I need one more. Okay. This is 1994, we have four women. That's right, leaders now. No, this is the year 200. We have more. So why don't you all sort of get together and kind of talk a little? Now this is basically the scenario. Now I won't say what the scenario is of the corporate business world, because I was a little bit surprised at what they're. So why don't you come with me and we'll talk a little bit about it so the rest of the group won't know. Sort of where you stand.
Go like that.
Gleason and Go Lightly.
Gleason and Go Lightly. Gleason and Go Lightly. Oh, yeah.
Gleason, the wheels of government. Okay, well, I'd just like to call this meeting to order. You all know why we're here. You all know the proposal that we have on the table, and it's our solemn duty to do what's best for the citizens of our great country.
I hope for that, man.
So I just would like to hear from each of you what your response is. How do you think we should handle this situation? I don't remember who is what.
Well, ask the Attorney General.
Ronald Reagan, he means.
As the Attorney General, I think we have a precedent that, you know, we could put together a legislative package modeled on the Selective Service Act of 1918. The courts have uniformly upheld this statute. Don't you think so, Greasy Tread Penny? That's something that's
Go Lightly.
And its predecessors are being well within congressional power to exact enforced military duty. We can ship them all off as a military thing at home or abroad by U.S. citizens. I don't see any congressional problems at all, but there will be some debate in Congress. But if the mail that they are receiving is anything like ours, then the pressure for passage will be irresistible.
So what you're saying is this is like a Selective Service.
Yes.
It's a time of national crisis.
And wouldn't you feel it's your duty, Mr. Tripp? Heavy?
Go Lightly.
Go Lightly.
Please, Go Lightly.
Greasy. I mean, Go Lightly. Okay, say thank you.
Thank you.
Don't you think that would be good? That appeal to your patriotism?
My patriotism?
Well, I think if there were any way that we could make it possible for the black population to think that they wanted to go rather than that we were forcing them to go, that would certainly be helpful, both for them in the specter of being dragged off against their will or sent off or marched off by the military into service or whatever, just is not something that we would be happy to watch happen and would have to deal with when we came back. But I'm not sure how to do it. I do know that if we could do that as Secretary of the Treasury, it's clear that our national debt would be in much better shape if we had that goal that we would get in exchange for it. You know, the last few years we've manipulated the money supply in order to keep things going, and that's been a real problem for you, Mr. President, in terms of the opposition calling you unscrupulous and just very difficult.
And I've supported you, Mr. President, at great loss.
I do appreciate
to me
that.
That is African American.
And you can count on my support. What do you think, as a black person yourself?
Mr. President, I've always supported you. I can't support you either. I can't support you on this one.
You cannot.
I cannot.
Well, is there anything,
Mr. President?
Well, is there anything that we can do? Is there anything? You know, I don't see. Realistically, I don't see how these creatures can tell if we have got every last black person in the United States. There's some places in Colorado, I think,
And what are you saying, Mr. President?
Well, I'm just saying that maybe, I mean, is there, you're in a unique position on this cabinet, and frankly, we all need to act patriotically. We all need to act for the good of the country.
Mr. President, as Secretary of the Interior, I really was greatly involved in the logging problem, of logging the old growth forest. And lots of people have told me I have not been very courageous. Well, that's probably right, but I would guarantee prosperity, if I could guarantee prosperity for our great country, by giving my life or even going with the space traders, I would gladly do it without hesitation. And if I would do it, I think every red-blooded American ought to be able to do it also. That's patriotism.
Mr. President, as the Secretary of Defense, I think the Secretary of Interior's courage is not unlike that of the American men and women who exhibited such courage when they were called to the military service. Some go more willing than others, but almost all go with the knowledge that they may not come back. Is it called a country that makes on the assumption that its citizens will respond? I think of the situation we have here. We need all of our African Americans to step forward on this case. And hopefully they will do respond as all citizens have done in years past to for the good of our nation. They will respond.
Mr. Golightly, don't you love your country? Don't you feel some loyalty to its good?
I can't accept this plan, Mr. President. I mean, what will I tell? They don't have any respect for me. What makes you think I can even convince them to accept this plan? I've sort of walked softly on both sides, though I do totally support you, Mr. President.
Chance for leadership?
In terms of history, that history books here.
But I have to go too.
You will have your family with you. And you will know. And you can tell the story in your new home of what you did.
I'm sure
the country of your birth.
You can't think people would take you into another place and not treat you good.
Let me just. In this situation, I just want to double check here and see exactly where we stand. In this time of national emergency and grave crisis for the United States of America, is there anyone here that thinks that somehow this trade is not a necessary step for the United States of America? Are we agreed that it's a necessary step? We're talking about how do we accomplish it?
Well, I know that I don't often speak at these meetings, but as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, from a human services standpoint, there are definitely benefits. I mean, you know, a large percentage of the black population does rely on welfare and other social programs, and the burden on the state and national budgets is considerable. I mean, just consider the black AIDS patients alone, and that cost is just skyrocketing. But I can't help but think that on the other hand, if we were to send all of these African-American people, that somehow the psychological effects in the rest of the nation would drive up healthcare costs that way, too. And so I do see the benefits, but I think we need to be prepared for what's going to happen if, you know, this is implemented.
Well, what do you think is going to happen?
I think there's going to be tremendous guilt as part of the national psyche. Who's going to be next?
Mr. President, do you really think a white American could live with themselves? If they sent all of us away, could they live with themselves?
We miss you.
I think the name of the place is Auschwitz. I hear it's really nice.
Well, that depends on how you look at it. I mean, you know, our charge as leaders of this great country is to do what's best for the country. And we've got some grave problems. Now, I only want to do what's best.
Besides, we were told we were supposed to send you off by our leader. My God.
I'm going.
Well,
if we could find a way, I would hope we would find a way to keep you here. But then I may not get elected again.
What would you recommend?
I think for the soul of America, we don't accept this trade.
What do you mean by the soul of America? How much is the soul going to matter if the body is absolutely dead? Our economy is going to pieces. Our environment has a level of toxicity, even though we don't acknowledge it, that is going to kill us all off before the next half century. Everywhere you look, we have done our best to try to solve these problems. We have given our life's blood to solve these problems, and they're intractable. They have not gone away. They worsen year after year after year. So you would prefer that we stay and just all die together.
But you're saying by sending the African Americans that will solve the problem.
Well, how does this differ?
We're selling ourselves for short-term gain. I mean, isn't that what America does all the time?
Well,
who created these problems? Mr. President, I do have faith. I have to say, always have faith in you, Mr. President.
That's music to my ears. I like to hear that. How does this differ?
And if you don't accept this trade, I'll make sure that you get the black vote in the next election, Mr. President.
You know, that is something we need to think about.
The next election?
Mm-hmm. And the black vote, if they're all gone.
We won't need the black
vote. We won't need it, and we will have everybody's support across who is left.
We could. I mean, how does this differ from other times of national emergency when we have sent thousands of young men of all races we have sacrificed in order to preserve our country? There have been many times when people have needed to step forward and make a sacrifice for the good of the country. This is not a choice that I would have designed, but under the circumstances, it seems like the best of two unpleasant options.
I think I'm going to have to resign my cabinet position.
Well, what's in there?
Okay.
We can't have mass resignations.
All right.
Well, let's just stop and see if there are any comments from the audience or from ourselves.
Well, as a business leader, we certainly can't let the aliens come in and take the black people away.
How would we get our crops out of the field?
Well, hold on. We're going to put you in the circle in a second.
It just makes my stomach crawl just to think about it. Yeah. I'm glad I didn't take one of those cards because I just don't think I could even pretend. But we were strictly enforced to do what we're doing, and that does make it very hard.
But do you think it seems very far-fetched that aliens would come and say, give us one. It does seem very far-fetched that would happen. But I mean, if America was at a state in the year 2000, which is not that far away, where we're destroying our natural resources, our economy is so bad and getting worse, and then, you know, we have no friends in the world. Is it so far-fetched that America would sell its soul for prosperity?
For an answer.
For an answer, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or for what they thought might be an answer.
I mean, there hasn't been. I mean, one of the things that this history,
which is, it's not specifically written up here, but every time there was a period of significant gain, there was also some, there also was some discussions in high places of how do we send them back to Africa? I mean, Abraham Lincoln did it, Benjamin Franklin did it. I mean, our great leaders were always trying to figure out a way to solve the race problem. And one of those resolutions was, let's send them back. They're just too much trouble for us. So let's, you know, we're going to reclaim America. We need to deal with our African-American problem. And I don't, you know, I like to think that it's far-fetched, but it doesn't have to be.
I kept waiting for you, Mary, to turn it around and say, well, if they were asking for you, would you go? You know, because it is easy in this country to employ minorities.
Well, but the fact is that governmental policy throughout our history has been that we'll sell our soul in order to save whatever the current crisis is. I mean, if you look at Native American treaties, and I mean, you make absolute covenants, and then when gold is discovered, you say they don't exist anymore, and you turn that over. I don't know. We have a bunch of things in the Minneapolis newspaper. It has been moving to come out here, where there over the last month or two, there have been revelations of sort of toxic experiments that were carried on around schoolyards 40 years ago or something, where the government's just wanting to, I mean, I think the discussion here would not have come down around why you do it. I mean, should we do it, shouldn't we? The whole discussion would have been, how do we package this so that we can do it and it'll work good, and it will be, and it will be so.
I think white America would say, if it were up to me, I would take your place. But of course, they don't want me.
Right.
And so it never gets down to it. And it's very easy to say, I would do it. But they want you, so you have to do it.
Were you going to say something?
Well, just kind of reinforcing that. We didn't go to Vietnam to save the Vietnam people. There was economic situations that dealt with. Or even though I don't understand all that, Civil War history, it's my understanding that Lincoln did not free the slaves in order to give the blacks freedom. There were many ulterior motives that went along with that.
Cotton.
It was, like you say, there's always that selling our soul.
Okay, before we run out of time, let's have the business people back. Business people up. Thank you very much. I'd support you all if you were cabinet members. Especially Mr. President. Mr. Golightly isn't in this
one. Oh, glad you
did.
Sure.
You sounded pretty articulate out there.
Hey, we got a problem. We got a real problem to deal with here. We're going to lose our butts if we don't get some kind of a way to stop this program of sending these blacks off. I mean, the whole thing, the whole American public is all set to do this. 80% of the population is ready to send these people off. And what's going to happen to us as the business leaders? I mean, what kind of business do you represent?
Well, in representing the coal and oil companies, this would be just absolutely catastrophic for us. If we have an inexhaustible clean fuel, I mean, that's what we're counting on. All our stockholders are counting on the price of oil going up and up and up as it gets more and more in demand. And we are going to lose our shirts if we bring in this stuff from these aliens. I mean, there is just going to be no hope.
It's an absolute disaster.
It is.
If we can't depend on our coal and oil and the profits from that, it's a disaster. What do you represent? What do you represent?
Well, I'm in a lot of things, but I'm also wealthy like we all are, and I think if you get rid of a certain
percentage of the population and the poorer whites are going to kind of realize that they've also been discriminated against, and there won't be kind of somebody, you know, a buffer zone there. So I think that we're going to have some social problems as a result of it. And I think we really need to start thinking about some solutions to kind of swing this.
We're scapegoats, aren't we? We're going to have a whole bunch of people mad at us that are on our side right now, because they're going to find out that they're on the low end, and we certainly don't want to, have them rebel against us, because we don't want to lose our position. Do you represent anyone else?
Well, I own a couple of sports teams.
Ooh.
I don't like us.
White men can't jump. We're not going to have anybody. What do you represent?
Well, I just represent the farmers out here who, you know, we have to have people go out there and pick all this truck farming that all these vegetarians want. And if it wasn't for the black man that would go out there and pick all these vegetables for a lesser cost than the white person, we would never get them out of the fields, because the white person is not going to go out there and pick those for the amount of money that I'm going to pay these white.
Well, I've got a couple of interesting businesses myself. I own some property in two areas. I own some property in the Black Ghettos. I want to make my profit off of renting there. And then I've got an arms company, and since we're banned handguns, we've got a, you know, most of our profits come from selling to police officers. And, you know, police, I certainly don't, you know, if we lose the black people, we certainly lose the need for arming our police. So we got a problem. The other thing is, we haven't thought about it, but they're going to give us all this gold. We're not, our money's going to be worth anything. You know, our money is based on scarcity.
We put all this gold right here in the
middle of the room. If we've got all this gold, our money isn't going to be scarce anymore. Well, how are we going to sell this now?
It's also going to affect our ability to control the government.
That's right.
You know what the government is?
If they've got all the gold, and we don't, then they're going
to control. You make a substantial contribution to my re-election.
What do we need to do? We're probably kind of running out of time here, so we probably got to figure out some.
We're going to have to probably, we got to get the cabinet and the Congress, maybe the American people, to vote against this. We have to come up with some legitimate reasons to get them to vote against it. We certainly can't let them do it simply because we want to remain rich. We're going to have to give them some other reasons.
I think we need to do more touchy feeling, though. I think we've got to come in and say, you know, if we do this, we're going to break up interracial families, and, you know, you're going to tear families apart. You know, I show pictures of people being torn apart and screaming children and some things like that.
Ooh, that's good.
Yeah. Let's get them there first.
let's get a block on the TV channel that says, make the Americans, the white Americans, aware of the fact that the cabinet, the president of the cabinet, are even proposing that they give these black people to the aliens carte blanche without any question.
You know what else we could do? We might be able to get the president on our side.
How?
Because, you know, if you remember back in the 80s, we had a president, early 80s, we had a president who didn't really understand economics. He was a conservative. And maybe we can confuse this guy, because he's a conservative too. Maybe we can confuse him with some mumbo-jumbo economics.
We probably did.
Yeah, and maybe he'll get on our side and not even know it was.
That's right. Yeah.
We could
often
build a presidential library with his name. And
he's going to get
support his next campaign.
Yeah, we got to support it, because he's going to get a presidential library, and we just want to make sure that...
But it'd be a very nice, it'd be probably the nicest one.
Okay, let's talk about this one a little bit.
These guys are good.
Was this the role that you thought that the business community would act in?
No. I thought they were going to want them to stay, but I expected somebody to say, yeah, I really value their business.
Well, that was my role. I never quite thought of it.
She had too many cars.
12% of the market generally consumed much more there.
besides, we make more profit on selling of cars and so on.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Other people.
Over time.
Any reactions to this scenario?
Well, both groups are being self-serving. The cabinet is trying to fix their knowledge by doing somebody else, you know, and it's saying that business. It's good business, so it's go back because there's any moral issues involved.
Moral didn't come into this, though.
Well, and also a lot of misinformation was bandied about, you know. And not any compassion was shown. Kind of like present day.
I think that the setup made it a little bit more possible because it was kind of ambiguous. It's possible for people to say, well, maybe it'll be really good for them when they go. I mean, it wasn't clearly laid out that they would be, it wasn't like you knew you were sending them to conferences or something like that, so you can say, well, maybe it'll be life.
And as the author writes, continues to sort of create this scenario, there is sort of the liberal community that's obviously the anti-trade coalition, and they're obviously is where there's a lot of moral arguments. They come up with a lot of, you know, let's try to change laws, let's have civil rights protests, let's sort of do the kinds of normal things. Let's try to find our allies. There was a Jewish rabbi that said, let's not support this because, you know, this is like what happened in Germany. But there was also self-interest in that because it was like, well, if we get rid of all the blacks, then we'll be the scapegoats. So, you know, sort of they're our buffer too. Then Golightly comes into this group and he tries to convince them that the way in which they convince the government not to support this is that you have to trick white people. That's the way we've been able to sort of gain some leverage is through making white people think that we're going to get something better than what they had. And that's his whole argument, that if we just convince them that we know that these space traders are taking us to the land of milk and honey, then maybe they'll be a little bit leery about having us go. But of course, the anti-trade coalition, because they don't support Golightly because he's a black conservative, says, forget about you. You know, we don't trust you. We don't believe anything that you say. So that's basically, and then they take a vote. I mean, he sort of writes this, that the American public take a vote.